I was a professor at the Santa Barbara Graduate Institute and enjoyed it
Yes.
immensely. I was working with master's and PhD students.
What do you think when you hear, when you read this, what we call hadith?
Every act of goodness is charity, even if it is just a smile.
And when a man loves his brother, he should tell him he loves him.
And that's what I've observed with Muslim people that I've known. That's my own limited understanding of Islam.
So another one here is, Allah just simply means God, yeah. The creator.
He's wise and prescient, as many of the things that I've heard Muhammad say are.
This is the Dean Show.
Welcome to the Dean Show. I'm your host. How are you guys doing? Every week we got an exciting guest, and this week is no exception. So we have Dr. Keith Witt, who's a licensed clinical psychologist, teacher, and author, who has lived and worked in Santa Barbara since 1973. He has conducted over 65,000 therapy sessions and published 8 books, presentations in the U.S. and internationally. Dr. Keith has explored love therapy, interpersonal relationships, and development from multiple perspectives, weaving neuroscience, integral theory, wisdom traditions, and numerous forms of psychotherapy in a coherent cosmology of love and healing. And he's also a Shotokan karate black belt. How you doing, Dr. Keith Witt? How are you?
Doing very well. I'm happy to be here with you today.
I'm happy to be with you also. Forget about all the big resume there. What about, tell me about this karate, Shotokan.
You know, that was my introduction to spirituality when I was 15. My family was going through a very difficult time. There was a lot of emotional upset and alcoholism, and my parents committed me to a hospital. And then in 1965, what they did with teenagers is give them electroshock therapy. And so they gave me electroshock therapy. And in that hospital at 15, I decided I needed to go deep and ask myself, how do I want to live in this world? And what I wanted was to be a healer and a warrior. And so when I got out of the hospital, I began studying psychology and Shotokan karate. And I had a black belt 3.5 years later, and I had my first license 10 years later. And Shotokan karate was my introduction into spirituality.
Wow, many people, wow, like we say, a warrior and a healer. Wow, this is deep. And many people, they've kind of forgotten about, you know, some of these, you know, traditions in the martial arts, you know, developing good character, integrity, and a lot of these traits that help you through life.
Yes, absolutely.
So would you recommend in your field, would you recommend this, you know, different life hacks of things that you can do? Would martial arts be one of those things that you recommend everybody get involved in?
Not everybody. I don't recommend anything for everybody because we're all different and unique.
Yeah.
If someone is delighted with the practice of a martial art, whether it's karate or tai chi or aikido or kendo or any of them, if it delights you to practice, if the philosophy moves your heart, then do it. And if it doesn't, mm-hmm. find something else that delights you and moves your heart.
A lot of my teachers are out there in California because I'm also involved in the martial arts. Oh, I've been also doing this for quite a...
What martial arts do you do?
I teach also a Gracie Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu.
Oh, Gracie, the best Jiu-Jitsu in the world, Gracie Jiu-Jitsu.
So the Brazilians, many of them, which we've learned from the Gracie family, you know, many of them, they're used to the nice weather in Rio and Brazil. So it's, yes, in California kind of matches that.
You know, I was a wrestler in high school. And the great thing about Gracie Jiu-Jitsu is that you can do all the things in Jiu-Jitsu that we weren't allowed to do when we were wrestlers in high school. It's a wonderful, probably the best grappling system that's ever been developed.
Well, don't get me started on wrestling. Wrestling, I mean, tremendous work ethic is built.
Oh, yes.
And it's amazing. Some of the hardest workers out there, you know, are wrestlers.
Yeah. No matter how hard I worked when I was a wrestler, I didn't feel like I was working hard enough.
Yeah. And that's another thing that just can carry you on with life.
So
now tell me, with all of your, you've been doing this for 40 years, huh?
Yeah, about that.
Yeah, so one part of your resume there, it talks about this integral theory. This is developed by, was it Ken Wilber?
Ken Wilber, yes.
Yeah, and what was I found interesting is this is more like it seemed like a holistic approach because putting many of the different things together, not excluding the mind, body, and soul and spirit,
Yes, oh,
which
absolutely.
kind of goes, a little bit away from the mainstream, which is just kind of pushing pharmaceutical drugs.
Oh, God. Don't get me started on pharmaceutical drugs. Integral, I discovered Integral in my 40s. It's a meta theory. It's an understanding of the universe that has pure science and empiricism on one side, pure spirituality on the other. And it's a structure that integrates both of those into a way of being in the world, doing your work, understanding the cosmos, understanding your spiritual connection to other people and to God. It's just was so exciting to me. It woke me up, and every single one of my books is informed by integral theory and is taking some aspect of the world that I think is important for people to know, and expanding it through the integral system, and offering it to people in ways that hopefully help them live and love better and grow better.
So we have some prophetic traditions that I just wanted to get you to comment on certain key words that from these quotations, how you see them, through your eyes as a clinical psychologist. Somebody's, because you talk about love, this is, a guiding force there in much of your therapy. And some of these other quotations and teachings probably maybe you haven't ever been exposed to. So I just want to get your honest feedback. And since you're more of an open-minded, therapist, and see what you think.
Sure. Sounds great. Every act of goodness is charity, even if it is just a smile.
This is a quotation by Prophet Muhammad.
Uh-huh.
So what is your, this is emphasizing, charity is something that's so important in Islam, but now even the point of smiling in someone's face, how important is this smile? So I'm focusing on smile. People read that Dan, what's his name from How to Win Friends and Influence
Oh,
People
yeah.
and many other great thinkers. What do you think when you hear when you read this what we call hadith?
We have tremendous effects on each other as human beings, every single one of us. And so when you pass someone, there's a relationship. If you meet someone's eyes, there's a relationship that's instantaneously formed. And if you offer them love through your smile, then they're enlivened. They're healed a little bit. And we all have the power to do that. And I think that the more that we grow, the more we feel a sense of responsibility to give that gift all the time. And I think that that is wise and prescient, as many of the things that I've heard Muhammad say are.
Also, you've heard of Prophet Muhammad.
Well, of course, I don't know much about Islam. I've studied all the religions. They all have so much to offer. It's a lot like the martial arts. When you get to the highest practitioners of the martial arts, if they sit around together, the different martial arts artists will agree with each other. The wisdom teachers that I've known, if you get them all together, they say, well, we agree. We agree that there's one race, the human race, and that there's one injunction. Let's do our best to serve God through our life. And so that's something that it seems to me that the wise people I've known have all agreed about.
Moving on to the next one, a statement: when a man loves his brother, he should tell him he loves him. Now, this can be for the also, it doesn't mean necessary for just a man. This is also for both man and woman. And you talk a lot about love.
I say I do. And what I mean by love is feeling at one with. And this particular one, many of us, for a variety of reasons, grow up feeling separate from other people. And we feel inhibited sometimes letting other people know how we feel. If you feel love for someone at any point, I think that it's wonderful and healing to share that.
How do you balance that? I'm guilty of both, like not doing both at times, because I'm usually in a deep state of thinking, reflection. So sometimes people will comment like, you know, I'm the program, I'm just doing what I love. So I'm smiling, I'm happy, but some, you know, I'm on off. I'm just really in a deep state of just a lot of times reflecting. I'm very, you know, my mind is thinking a lot and whatnot. So sometimes I'll get criticized, like, where's your smile? You lost. So I got to remind myself, how do you balance that now? Because I don't want to be fake. You know, I just feel like if I'm just putting on a smile, I don't want to feel like I'm being fake.
Well, of course not. It's, you know, we go back and forth between being connected with other people and being more inward, connected with our own selves. And we have so much that we're having to deal with every moment as human beings. There's material flowing up from our unconscious, what I call shadow, our adaptive unconscious, all the time. Feelings, stories, impulses, memories, ideas. And so how we deal with that determines how we move through the world. I write a lot about that in my book, Shadow Light. And so sometimes when you're caught up inside yourself, you're not really connecting to the outside world. Now, if other people see you like that and they're used to having you be engaged and smiling, they might worry. They might go, oh no, he's mad at me. He doesn't like me. And so they'll interrupt in a way, and they'll say, well, are you having a problem? And then again, you respond, no, I was having an inward moment. And as you look at them and connect with them, then that connection, that energetic connection that we all have, gets reestablished. And then your warmth is communicated again. And, you know, people, we're insecure. It's very difficult to grow up and be a human being. And so we often will feel insecure with other people. And when that happens, if we talk about it with each other with open hearts, we can resolve it.
Beautiful. Thank you for sharing that with us. Here's the next one. And I want just to relate like how these work, kindness. So the one here is about kindness. So we went from the first one, the smile, you know, talking about the importance of that and this being mentioned in the prophetic traditions. And then we had the second one about, you know, being open to, sharing your love for someone. Let me just touch upon going back to that, because as men, you know, we kind of more reserved, right?
That's right.
So in your therapy sessions, do you tell, like, let's say the brother to tell his brother, or, you know, how do you relay that in actual in your therapy sessions, like being open about your love towards your family member or someone close to you, your wife or cousin?
I'm generally quite transparent about that. Generally, whatever is going on inside of me will be shared with someone else. I think kindness is huge. You know, I've probably done somewhere, I don't know, 25,000 sessions with couples, okay? And inevitably, if there's a problem with a couple, I mean, almost every single time, it's because someone has forgotten to be kind. And when couples start trying to be kind to each other, good things happen. When parents start trying to be kind to their children, good things happen. When children start trying to be kind to their parents, good things happen.
So another one here is Allah just simply means God, the creator, is kind, and he loves kindness in all matters.
Well, first of all, it reminds me of the last line of one of my favorite books, A Book of Five Rings by Miyamoto Musashi, that was written in 1645 about the way of the warrior. And in it, he said, in the void is virtue and no evil.
And no evil.
Wisdom has existence. Principle has existence, the way has existence, and spirit is nothingness. In other words, in the void, there's no evil. That if we're open to the infinite, that what comes through us is kindness and understanding.
I want to just also kind of, you were talking about what's in your mind and you being transparent. I want to be transparent with you also, is because one of the main reasons that we do the Dean Show is to dispel many of the myths and misconceptions and help to bridge, you know, the gap of misunderstanding, because the media really hasn't done a good job of doing that. And most people, when you do surveys, they know nothing about Islam or Muslims. And a lot of times their opinions are formed by the misinformation that's put out there by the media. And this creates division in humanity, fear, and then fear leads people to doing unreasonable things. And they end up, a lot of times it can lead to violence.
I agree.
So, yeah, so by doing many of these programs, we try to bridge that gap of misunderstanding and to really show what Islam is about and connecting, you know, with our fellow humans and humanity, right? So this is kind of just to see the other side, because you don't see the media talking about some of these beautiful core teachings that were brought by Prophet Muhammad, by God Almighty.
Oh, yeah. You know, I have an aunt and uncle, Dorothy Nelson and James Nelson, who's recently died. He died several years ago, who were very, very central figures in the Baha'i faith. And they're the ones that showed me the Quran for the first time. In the Baha'i faith, the Quran is a sacred text. And they said, it's beautiful, Keith, and they were right. You know, that people grow through stages, and also traditions grow through stages. At a particular stage of development, when people have a self and other orientation and a sense of threat, then that sense of threat and that self and other can lead to violence. That's true for every tradition. But if people grow, they grow towards a sense of unity with everyone and a sense of experiencing God as a fountain of love and kindness. And that's what I've observed with Muslim people that I've known. That's my own limited understanding of Islam. And that's been my experience.
Yeah. So the Islam has two main sources that it goes by. The Quran, which we say is the verbatim word of God Almighty, Allah, the Creator. And then you have the authentic statements, prophetic statements of the last and final messenger, we say, was sent to mankind, Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him. Which, by the way, Muslims believe in all the preceding, the messengers that came before him, Jesus, Moses, Abraham, and we believe that they all came with the same message, worship one and only one God, and be morally upright.
Yeah.
So here's another one, be kind. Whenever kindness becomes a part of something, it beautifies it. Whenever it is taken away from something, it leaves it tarnished. This is another on kindness. So in your therapy sessions, do you see one party or the other, or both sometimes, like you said, lacking, you know, this essential quality of kindness?
Well, yeah. Well, you know, when we're frightened, when people are threatened, feel threatened. Okay. Now, feeling threatened isn't the same as being threatened. Just feeling threatened. If somebody appears in a way that scares you or says something that triggers a memory or something, what happens is your nervous system starts protecting you. And what it does is it creates a state of consciousness that separates you from the other person and gives you impulses to fight or run from that other person. Those are called defensive states. And they happen often. And if you're aware of that, you can go, oh, I'm in a defensive state. And you can go, so what's compassionate understanding of me and this other person? But if you're not aware of that, then you'll end up instinctively telling yourself stories that support fighting with this other person or running from this other person. And you lose kindness when you do that. And so one good hook for some people is to notice when they're not feeling kind and then go, wait a minute, let me anchor myself in kindness again. Sometimes that works, but like I said earlier, nothing works for everybody. Everybody has their own path forward.
I believe earlier, I don't know if you said something about race, and I just thought about this prophetic tradition that talks about the white has no superiority over the black, and black has no superiority over the white, except in piety and good action. You know, this is something in today's day and age where you have a lot of still racism that's affecting us sadly.
And yes, yeah, I remember, and also men and women, masculine and feminine. My Aunt Dorothy, when she was teaching, she would always use the metaphor of the two wings of the dove. She said the masculine is one wing, the feminine is the other, and you know, you need both wings to fly. And I think that's true for the whole human race too. You know, it's just we're one. But again, when people are threatened, they tend to see a self and another. And that's with an individual or even with a group. And when those threats happen, that's when the bad things happen in the world. That's when the bad things happen in relationships. And to the extent we can catch those things and adjust to compassion, good things happen.
I want to focus on this next one, self-control, self-restraint. It seems that it was once a forgotten place in the center of psychology. A turning point was triggered in a now famous study by Walter Mischel.
It was the famous marshmallow experiment.
Yes, the marshmallow study, where they offered one marshmallow now or two later to go ahead and test the ability of delayed gratification. You know, Dr. Ellen Galinsky also, she concluded from so many reviews of thousands of studies that the seven essential life skills for children to reach the full potential, and the number one was that self-control.
That's right.
Then you
That's
have right. the world's most prolific psychologist, Dr. Roy Boymister from the Florida State University.
I love that guy.
You know, he talks about in his book, willpower, success, intelligence, and success. Self-control being at the top. So can we talk a little bit about that self-restraint, self-control? There's one here, prophetic tradition, that talks about the strong person is not the person who overpowers one with adversities or takes him to the ground or can out-wrestle him, in some other narrations talks about, but a strong person is the one who contains themselves when they're angry.
Yes. So this is more complicated than it sounds. And the reason for that is that we're all born with different temperamental capacities and types. For instance, self-control is highly correlated with conscientiousness. Some people are born with more capacity for conscientiousness. Some people are born with less capacity for conscientiousness. And so I don't want people to judge themselves if they have more difficulty with self-control it's easy for me to do self-control and it should be easy for everyone. What we can agree about is that self-control, that self-observation and then that ability to pause before action and then make a good choice is a good thing. It's a healthy thing. And so what you do with children and what you do with people is you start where they are, wherever they are in their capacity to self-regulate, whether it's their emotions or their behaviors, and you go, okay, we start where you are, fully accept where you are, and now let's move towards better affect regulation, better willpower, self-control. You know, Baumeister in his book on willpower quoted a number of studies, not just the Mischel studies, but other studies that have been done over the years on how we can learn self-control, how we can learn affect regulation. And all of them are based on an understanding. There's a directionality to this. In other words, when we're talking about willpower, we're talking about being able to make healthy choices. We're talking about regulating emotion, affect regulation. We're talking about being able to keep ourselves in a certain level of arousal and with a certain compassionate attitude towards other people so that we can have good relationships and we can function optimally as individuals. And so some of us will have to work harder at it. Some of us don't have to work so hard. That's just the way humans are. And so that's psychotherapy, coaching, spiritual work. All of it involves accepting who you are at this moment and then as fast as you can, whatever your rate of growth is, growing towards these qualities of kindness, affect regulation, self-control that we know are good for human beings, capacity to love, to express love, all those things.
You write about something to the effect of we all go crazy or we lose it at times.
Everybody goes crazy sometimes.
Everybody goes crazy sometimes. So how do you, can you articulate a little bit more into that? Like, what do you mean? I know what you mean, but for our audience,
I understand.
I think I know what you mean.
Yeah, I think you do. You know, when I talked earlier about those defensive states, those defensive states, when we feel threatened by another and our unconscious sets that state up, that's a powerful state. You have amplified or numbed emotions. You have a distorted story. You have the diminished capacity for self-reflection and empathy. You have destructive impulses. This happens to us when we feel threatened. So when that happens, and if I indulge those destructive impulses, If I elaborate on that negative story, you're bad because of this. Oh, and let me remember another reason why you're bad. If I stay disconnected from you and don't reach for understanding of your heart, if I stay disconnected from myself and don't go, Keith, you're in a defensive state. If I don't do those things, then I'm going to basically do damage. I'm going crazy. Now, there's little bits of going crazy, what I call normal crazy. And then there's big bits of going crazy, which I call extra crazy. And extra crazy is particularly dangerous. Okay. Normal crazy is honking your horn at somebody because they're not going fast enough. Extra crazy is stopping your car and punching them. Okay. Normal crazy, extra crazy. And you know,
or doing jumping out and doing some Shotokan on them.
Yeah, oh God. You know, one thing they discovered with martial arts, which I love, is, you know, guys that used to get in fights a lot, when they start studying martial arts, they get in fewer fights. Why?
That's true. So true.
People don't understand martial arts is way more about control, self-awareness and self-control than it is about violence and aggression.
So if you got like so many kids and, you know, it's driving the mother crazy, she loses it, you know, don't hold that against her, huh?
Of course right? not.
So, or if the husband comes home and he's had a long day at work, whatever the case, obviously he's not being violent, physical, but, you know, sometimes, like you said, we make excuses for each other. I say, you know, but don't, the thing is where sometimes a person will lose it. And I'm not talking about going to an extreme, violent, crazy, but someone might, you know, who's normally doesn't utter profanities or normally is in line with good moral character, but then they just lose it, and then you want to hold that, you forget about. There's a statement from a very prestigious scholar in Islam. He talks about, you know, when a man does some, a man can do 99 good things, then he does one bad thing, and you want to hold him to that one bad thing.
Well, I've said similar things. And I said it to men often. Yeah, and never mind 99 and 100. You can do 9,999 minutes of good acts. And you do 1 minute of emotional or physical violence, and you will be defined by that minute of emotional and physical violence by other people. Now, there's reasons for that. We're wired to be aware of threats and to avoid them. This is deep in the human genome. And so knowing that makes us, can teach us that as we get distressed, angry, or frightened, instead of surrendering to our impulses, we can slow down and question our impulses. I have less, instead of being more certain of our hostile beliefs, we can become suspicious of our hostile beliefs. I don't really trust what I think if I'm super anxious, if I'm frightened, or if I'm angry. I don't believe that the thoughts that I have or the stories that I have are true stories. I think they're distorted. I don't trust them until I can have compassionate understanding of those stories. And then I'll have more faith. And when I'm working with couples and when I'm working with individuals or I'm working with kids or I'm working with families, I teach them this. You know, so you make a mistake, fine. Let's limit the amount of damage. Let's heal from it. But also let's learn from it. If you're not learning from your mistakes, then that eventually erodes your relationships with other people. And so it's not just forgive yourself for your mistakes. We need to learn from them and grow from them. And if we're doing that in relationships, that makes us safe and makes it easier to forgive each other. If we're not learning from our mistakes, then eventually the people that are close to us will leave us because it'll be too frightening for them for us not learning.
In psychology, I don't know how long this term, there's some new terms that have been developed and coined, and one of them that comes to mind is narcissism, narcissist. So can you help define these terms, this word, and what are some of the signs of that? And also, so someone, if they have one, are you classified a narcissist if you have one or three of those signs, or is this something kind of, you know, open to interpretation? And at the end, in the essence of trying to avoid, you know, falling into being one of these?
Well, first of all, there's lots of different definitions of narcissism. The definition in the Diagnostic Manual of Psychology has, there's a series of characteristics of being manipulative, being self-absorbed, feeling grandiose, feeling entitled, and to the extent that it interferes with your relationships in your life. And then that, according to the diagnostic manual, that's pathological narcissism. Now you got to remember that that diagnostic manual was created the first time in the early 50s, just so that psychiatrists could bill insurance companies. I mean, that's why it's there. You know, all those characteristics are just descriptions of characteristics that people have said, okay, this makes this means something. Yeah.
Wait, help us. So I'm understanding that correctly. So this term was coined in the 1950s.
Yeah. Well, earlier than that. It was coined. Sigmund Freud, when he was coming up with his understanding of the unconscious, encountered people that were chronically self-absorbed, selfish, and entitled. And he said that, and he saw that interfering with them, and he said that was narcissism. Now, also later on, some of his students, Melanie Klein among them, when they were looking at kids, they realized when a child is about 10 or 11 months old, that child feels like they're the greatest thing in the whole world. Everybody's been just loving them for 9 or 10 months. Anything they do has been wonderful. And so that's called primary narcissism, and that's really healthy in it. We want 10 and 11 month old kids to feel like they're God's gift to the world. Now, in the next year, those kids will learn that they have to adapt to culture. But you want them to keep that sense of, I am a good person, and I am a unique instrument of God in the world. And that's healthy narcissism. That's a healthy sense of myself as somebody who has the power to help or to hurt, and I want to help. And so that's part of the complexity. Here's another thing that's part of the complexity. In the last 100 years, one of the things that has happened in the world is it's become more and more acceptable to be a unique person. People get much less attacked or hurt for being different in today's world. And this has happened rapidly, particularly over the last 70 years. So part of that has been, instead of learning how to primarily conform to the cultures around you, what you see, particularly in Western parenting, is we want to find out who you are as a child, and we want you to be the best version of yourself. Now, this is mostly a healthy thing. But also, when you start having a culture that says, well, we need to have less conformity to cultural standards and more personal, like being the best version of yourself, it tends to create a lot more narcissism at certain stages of development. And we've seen that with college students and with teenagers. The levels of narcissism at that stage of development have gone up a lot. Now, if those kids keep growing, they become less entitled and less feeling less superior and special, and they start feeling more of a sense of everyone has something to offer, including me. They become more honest. They become more humble if they keep growing. But some people don't keep growing. Some people get stuck, and then they're stuck in that narcissistic place. In the personality research, this is called the H factor, the honest and humble factor. Some people are born with a lot of capacity for that. Some people are born with less capacity for that. And if you're born with less capacity for that, if you're born more egocentric and entitled, and that is actually a personality trait, then you have to work harder to become humble. You have to work harder to become honest. And you can. We can all grow. For some people, it's easier. Some people, it's harder. And some people, they get caught in I'm special, you don't count. And this is the most pathological form of narcissism. When you see other people as objects to give you supply and to worship you, essentially, and to serve you, and you don't feel any responsibility to care for them. And that is pathological narcissism, and that causes an awful lot of problems in the world. And we see it, and unfortunately, we see it a lot in leaders, because people that are low on that honesty and humility frame and high on narcissism, those people tend to want to be in charge of other people. And so there's a lot of them in politics, unfortunately.
Just to go back real quick, you mentioned something about billing the insurance company. What was that about? So they how did they had to make some kind of diagnosis?
Yeah.
So if you fit any of those qualities, then how did that work with the billing the insurance company?
Well, you know that there's this whole business of healthcare in this country, which unfortunately is a mess, and that's all there is to it. And it is corrupt. Pharmaceutical industry, from my perspective, the insurance industry, the healthcare industry, is full of well-meaning people doing their best to do right, and yet when you get to the money side of it, it's corrupt. And so one thing that happened in 1950 is the psychiatrists were upset that they were treating people and they weren't able to bill insurance companies who weren't paying them because it wasn't like fixing a broken arm when somebody came in depressed and you talk to them. So they created the diagnostic manual, the first one. We're on the fifth version now, where it describes psychological issues, use medical terms so that the insurance companies eventually would be forced to have to reimburse psychiatrists and then psychologists later on for doing treatment. And for every subsequent level, you know, it's called the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. And it wasn't supposed to be used originally for treatment. It was supposed to be used for research, but you know, that part of it got lost very quickly. And so every time that it comes out, there's more problems that people have that are framed as pathologies, you know, depression, anxiety, OCD, personality disorders, and so on, so that psychotherapists can put those on insurance forms, and the insurance companies have been forced to reimburse for some of that. And that's just the way, but that's the way healthcare works pretty much with everything in this country. It is just not a healthy environment when you have people who are not doctors who are gating medical treatments for people that need attention. And the people that need attention sometimes have to wait weeks and months to get attention. You know, it's just a problem. And that's one of the reasons why the United States has eight times as much depression now as they did three generations ago, and why we're like 17th or 18th healthiest of all the first world countries. And we pay twice as much for our healthcare as all the other countries. It's because it's a system that is a corrupt system, and that eventually will, I assume, heal, you know, because evolution is inevitable. But right now, there's a lot of problems with it.
Mm-hmm. Just a few more questions before we conclude. So we talked about narcissism. Would the antidote to that be, you said humbleness, and one of those ways brings us back to this statement here, the best among you are those who have the best manners and character.
Yeah, you know.
What do you think about this statement?
Well, first of all, I always remember, you know, Muhammad was a leader. You know, he was a soldier. He was a leader. He was in the real world having to deal with real problems, geopolitical problems, management problems. I mean, I think that shaped him to be very, very practical in terms of who are the people that have the best impact, who are the people that are the best leaders, what are the ways of being as a culture that makes you the most secure culture. And so as that, he would notice that people that had good character and that had good manners, those are the people that were the good leaders, the good managers, the people that could, and then as they were in charge, the people under them would feel, okay, the world is fair, and this is what we all want. We want fairness and care. The people in charge are interested in us being cared for and us and being fair with us. And I think that relaxes people and makes them more generous.
From a psychological standpoint, now study, we know that, you know, there's through a lot of hardship, a lot of times when a person is going through a trial of hardship, they don't see like the good. But can you tell us like some of the greatest people? You know, Oprah Winfrey, she talks about in her book, you know, all the different trials that she went through and everything that made her. So many people, the suffering at the end, they persevered and it made them who they are. So this is just one quotation that talks about when God wants good for someone, he afflicts them with trials. When you have someone coming to you and they just trial upon trial, you know, tests of life, they're going crazy. Like, how do you deal with this term, trials, the tests of life?
First of all,
however you call it in psychological terms.
Well, first of all, we all have them. We all have challenges. We all have trials. And one thing that my aunt used to tell me is she said, God never gives you trials that you cannot deal with.
Wow. This is powerful. You know, this, I'm sorry to interject, but there's a statement in the Quran where God Almighty is saying that God does not burden a soul more than it can bear.
Well, yeah, you know, obviously, you know, well, she was the Baha'i, right? Obviously the Bab who revered the Quran got a lot of his stuff from Baha'u'llah, got a lot of their stuff from the Quran. I'm sure that there's an awful lot of Baha'i quotes like that that come directly from the Quran. We all have trials. Being a human is not an easy thing. And some of them are necessary. It's a necessary initiation from childhood into adolescence into adulthood. That is difficult. That's a trial. And that's why all cultures have had initiation ceremonies that they've created to help guide young people into discovering who they are and being themselves virtuously in the context of their various communities and assemblages. So what's difficult, though, is when someone feels overwhelmed by a trial and crushed to the extent that they don't feel like they have power to grow or to learn or to understand. And so in therapy, part of your job is to validate the fact that a trial is painful and it's difficult. And sometimes they're brought to us from the cruelty of other people or by the caprice of nature or by bad luck sometimes. And it doesn't matter how it comes to us. Once we experience it, now it's our responsibility to understand, to accept, and to grow and learn from that. And as we have that orientation, we become happier. Our unconscious and our bodies will vote. If we're trying to do right, if we're trying to be kind and compassionate, if we want to learn from our trials and mistakes, we become happier. We become more loving people.
Yeah. So you mentioned, Baha'i a couple of times. Did you say your mother?
My aunt Dorothy.
Oh, your aunt.
Yeah.
Your aunt.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is your aunt that you picked up a couple of these statements from that you mentioned earlier, and then one right now.
Oh, yeah. We used to have many, Aunt Jim Nelson, Dorothy Nelson, and I used to have many, many conversations like this. I got to say, my uncle really didn't like it that I got some of my spiritual orientation from martial arts. Particularly from Miyamoto Musashi, the Book of Five Rings. He was quite disappointed.
Yeah.
We would have arguments about that. Those kinds of arguments, that dialectic is a tradition that I find in all the wisdom traditions. And that's how knowledge goes forward. You know, we look for better understandings. There's always a better understanding. There's a deeper understanding ahead. And it's useful to know that my understanding now is just the best that I have right now.
Yeah. If someone asks you, like, you know, for you, just for your information, so this is like where you have more of the orthodox, where you have like Muslims, and simply just to define these terms, a Muslim is any person who peacefully submits to the creator of the heavens and earth, and that's how you get peace and life. And Islam simply means submission to the creator, not the creation, in simple layman terms. And then adhering to the verbatim word of God. And then you have this authentic tradition, prophetic reports that say A said, B said, C said. And A is a person, B is a person, C is a person, where you know their whole biography, their history, if their memory was weak, if they were known for lying or anything. We don't accept any of that.
Mm-hmm.
We wouldn't narrate from that individual. And this is how we stick within the boundaries of Islam. So this is the orthodox view, following the Sunnah, the way of Prophet Muhammad.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what we say, the Quran and the Sunnah. So just a couple more questions. Sibling rivalry, because you also write a lot about, children and whatnot. How do you stop this? Is this something that for a 14-year-old, you know, with his younger brothers and sisters, and you just can't figure out your mind. You're scratching your head. Why is there so much fighting with the younger ones? Is this something they outgrow? How do you deal with this, Professor?
You know, if you have kids under nine, children under nine, They argue on an average, if you just studied a bunch of them, they argue with their siblings on an average of once every 20 minutes. Okay.
Wow.
I know. It was every 20 minutes. So, you know, for all those parents out there worried about their kids arguing too much, hey, look, you know, you're right at the top of the bell curve when your kids argue a lot. You know, families are cultures. You know, when a family comes to me, they come to me with whatever their culture is at that moment. We start working with it. Usually what happens with children, and this is for teenagers too, is when there's distress, it comes out in how they behave and what they say and what they think. It'll come out in a form of emotional violence or sometimes physical violence, mostly emotional. And so one thing that you do is you stop violence. You know, if kids are screaming, you interrupt them. If kids are fighting, you know, you separate them. And then what you do is you wait until their arousal goes down enough so that they can relate. And then you go, okay, so you just were very angry at your brother or your sister. Yeah, I was. And, you know, so what were you angry about? So you validate the emotion, but not the behavior. You look for, is there a problem that needs attention? Yeah, you took my truck and I didn't say yes. Well, okay, that's not fair. So let's now set a boundary. Let's go tell your brother, you can't take the truck without permission. You give the truck back. No, you know, apologize for taking the truck without permission. You know. You do that, and then you move on, okay? This is called emotional coaching. It's been studied extensively, particularly by John Gottman up in Seattle. If you do this form of emotional coaching with your children, and it needs to involve setting boundaries. I mean, you can't let a kid do damage to you or to another kid. A kid's screaming and out of control. Put them in their room, let them calm down. But if you do this emotional coaching that includes these firm but kind boundaries, kids are doing better by the time they're 8 or 9 and they're 14. They're doing better with other kids. They're more social. They're doing better at school. They have more willpower. They have more ability to do affect regulation. And so with issues that come up with kids, you just keep leaning into that system again and again and again, patiently. And you don't just do it once. You do it thousands of times. Some kids need it only a little bit. I have 2 children. I have a son and a daughter. My son, well, he embraced this. And so it was easy for him to get into the flow of us. My daughter didn't. She resisted more. She had, you know, I had OCD in my family, obsessive compulsive, and she had some of that. That makes you anxious. And so I had to do it more. We had to put more energy into helping her than we did with him during certain stages. Kids are different. Some of them need more attention, some need less. Both of them are doing great now. They're 33 and 36 at this point. And so that's how you deal with it. It's you start where you are, and then you connect, and then you find a way to create a little insight and a little healthy behavior, a little understanding, and then you declare victory and move on to the next thing.
You call it emotional coaching.
It's called emotional coaching, as opposed to emotionally dismissing. Emotionally dismissing is you guys all shut up and get over it. Okay, you know, Johnny hurt me. That's too bad. You know, go back. You know, go on. Now, you know, that's okay once in a while. You fall down when you're playing soccer and you go, God, I got hurt. And you go, yeah, I understand, but get back into the game. Okay, there's sometimes that's necessary. But mostly when it comes to things that feel strongly, emotional coaching is better for children. It's not just better for children and teenagers, it's better for all of us. Okay. It's a better way for us to be as human beings. It's respectful, it's self-reflective, and it keeps us understanding we're all emotional people who have emotions come up all the time. Like you and I right now, as we relate with each other, we have emotions that are coming up that have to do with how we feel about each other as well as how we feel about these topics. And so it's important to be aware of the sacred quality of that. I think that's sacred. To me, that's sacred.
The last thing, and I'm sure you can talk about this for a long time, but just in short, maybe when we have you back on again, God willing, we can talk more in depth on this. But how much, what I like about your approach is that you're just not, because the majority of psychiatrists, when you think of psychiatrists, you go there and they make you numb, meaning that they just give you a pill and now that pill leads to another pill, and then you're on a cocktail of medications, and then you're just like a walking zombie, right? How much does food play a role in mental health, in good health, and in your type of psychiatry?
Well, first of all, and also psychiatry is changing. There's a lot of psychiatrists now that are reluctant to prescribe the drugs and will go to other things first. But you're right, this whole pharmaceutical model, you know, like depression is a biochemical imbalance. That actually was a narrative that was created by the drug companies, and it's a false narrative. And it's caused a lot of damage, and it continues to cause a lot of damage. Diet, if to address emotional distress, what we're dealing with is self, culture, and nature. So it's body, mind, and spirit in self, culture, and nature. And in integral, we call that an integral life practice. And what that means is all these things fit together. So sleep is important. Diet is important. Don't eat too much sugar. Intoxicants. If you have an emotion, there's ways of growing through that emotion. If you try to suppress it or deny it or make it go away, generally you will amplify it and cause problems. Food is very important, and not just what foods you eat, when you eat those foods, and how you eat those foods, and with whom you eat those foods, because we're eating is social. And so if we eat in a way that is pro-social, we digest better, and also our mood is elevated. And so just contact with other people, having purpose in our life, having a sense of connectedness to spirit and a sense of unity with God. All these things, as you cultivate them, change your mood and elevate it. And these are the things that I encourage people to go to first with anxiety, with depression, with obsession, those kinds of things. You adjust those things. Now, there's also a lot of other stuff that you do because, again, we're very complex beings. But diet is super important. And there's way too much sugar, way too much processed food. And also, there's a lot of toxins in food, frankly. A lot of processed foods have chemicals in them that are just not good for us. That's why, you know, eat organic food. Why? Glyphosate is a universal toxin that's put on non-organic food, and you don't want to get that in your body. It's a carcinogen, and also it infects your mood. You know, don't eat that stuff.
And that model you said was created by the pharmaceutical company. The one, what is it called?
Oh yeah, the Prozac, the serotonin hypothesis. They found this drug that increased the amount of serotonin. Though they still don't know if that's what did it. And some people felt better. About a quarter of the people felt better when they took it. The pharmaceutical company created this narrative, hired people, hacks, to write studies, suppressed the studies that said it wasn't good for you, suppressed the side effects, marketed the hell out of this stuff. And now 10% of the people in this country are on drugs, mostly those. And you can just, if you look in the fish in the Pacific and the Atlantic, they have measurable dose, they have measurable levels of these serotonin drugs in the fish. So much of it has been washed out to sea from the United States. And the major medical organizations, the American Psychiatric Journal, the New England Journal of Medicine, have dedicated issues saying, we apologize for publishing studies that the insurance, that the pharmaceutical companies foisted on us as good research. And we apologize for foisting the serotonin hypothesis when the data really didn't support it. I mean, this is a big deal. And it's still happening. And it's just, you cannot reduce depression to a biochemical imbalance. It's way too complex for that. There's all kinds of other things, including diet, including relationship, including spirituality, that are necessary for us to feel less anxious, less depressed, more engaged in the world.
And this is coming from clinical psychologist Dr. Keith Witt, over 40 years of experience, also as a professor at Stanford University.
No, I'm not a professor at Stanford. I was.
You taught at what university? You were a professor at what university?
I was a professor at the Santa Barbara Graduate.
Santa Barbara, that's what it is. Sorry, I got them confused.
Yeah, no, the Santa Barbara Graduate Institute many years, a few years ago was sold, and then, so it doesn't exist. But while it existed, I was a professor at the Santa Barbara Graduate Institute and enjoyed it immensely. I was working with master's and PhD students, and they were wonderful. And the institute, I'm sorry it's not still around. It was a wonderful institution.
Thank you for spending some time with us, Professor.
Well, I really enjoyed this. And, keep doing your good work.
Thank you very much. God bless you. Thank you so much. People can find you on DrKeithWitt.com?
Dr. Keith Witt, DrKeithWitt.com. You can, I have classes. I have many blogs. I have videos. You can find my books, Shadow Light on Shadow, Loving Completely on Relationships, The Gift of Shame about development and shame, and The Attuned Family about attunement being a central thing in attunement. And if you're a therapist, I wrote two of the first books on integrally informed psychotherapy, Waking Up and Sessions. And you can get all those books on Amazon Prime.
Thank you very much. God bless you. Thank you. Hopefully we can do this again sometime in the future.
Hopefully we can do it again. Bye-bye.